Boker Tov, everybody. Welcome to our Yom Iyun. We're looking forward to a wonderful day of learning. And it's a pleasure to have as our leadoff hitter, I don't know if you follow baseball at all, but Rachel Danziger-Sharansky, who we've had many times before, really from Yerushalayim. Just her talk is being sponsored in memory of Judith Rudolph, as her Shloshim comes to an end. It's being sponsored by her five children, Suri and Robert Sugarman, Sima and Herman Hertzberg, Shoshana and Chuck Levine, Naomi and Mark Noller, Daniela and Joshua Rudolph. Thank you. They talk about her mother's commitment to learning and to studies being an inspiration for the whole family, and I'm sure for many in our community. So thank you very much. We should have good memories and long life for everybody. Rachel Vakasha.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Kalman, and thank you to the Rudolph family. I was sorry to hear about your loss. And without further ado, let us delve right in. And I want to say right away, before I start with the source sheet and before we start digging into it, that when we start reading the Megillah, we face an interpretational problem, or an interpretive problem, I should say. Namely, that we read it so many times and heard it so many times that it's hard for us to read it as it's shot. We can't quite read it without remembering what follows after. I mean, it's true, I think, also of Parashat Teshuvah, for example, but the Megillah we read twice in one holiday. And if we happen to travel out of Jerusalem and then back to Jerusalem, sometimes four times in one holiday. So it's a little bit difficult to treat the beginning of the story or any part of it as if it's new to us. And yet I want to try and do exactly that. I want to try and go into the beginning of the Megillah before we know just how far Ahasuerus is willing to indulge his ministers, before we know just how dangerous these ministers can prove to be. And think for a second about the early descriptions of the party, of the Mishteh. And the truth is that those descriptions don't look particularly alarming. I know that Chazal read into it all these undertones of Ahasuerus celebrating his supremacy and bringing out the Kelim from Beit HaMikdash to celebrate winning over God. But in the Pshat, it's just a party where a king is sharing a lot of things with his people, where he's being very, very generous, where he's inviting many people who probably normally would not be invited into the palace to enjoy his largesse. And yet the very abundance of favor that goes on in those early psukim of the Megillah leaves us feeling that there's no room there for anything that isn't part of the king's gravity field and anything that orbits around him. Allow me to elaborate on that for a moment. When you read the early psukim of Megillah, when you see the kind of power and wealth that Ahasuerus yields, it feels like it fills the space. Like there's no open spaces. There's no gaps. There's nowhere one can just be quietly and enjoy a private moment, so to speak. Wherever you turn in that glittering world of Shushan, someone is there offering you a cup of wine or a piece of gold or shesh or argaman is there to blaze color in your face. And it's that fullness of material goods, of the beneficence of the kings, that played a role in leading Chazal to say that it's not just that the name of God isn't mentioned in the Megillah. It's that there's no room for God in the world of the Megillah, in the world of Shushan, I should say. It's so filled with the king and everything the king can offer, that to find God there, one would have to look very, very, very hard, because there's no moment and no space that is empty enough to allow people to go into introspection, to seek something spiritual. The here, the now, the glitter is in your face all the time and taking your space. And as Rabbi Silber points out in one of his articles about the Megillah, the Megillah emphasizes this impression of a material world that's very rich and saturated and replaces or displaces any room for spiritual journeys by using language that in the Torah is used to describe the Mishkan. And I'm not going to bring sources for this because we have a very short amount of time, but Rabbi Silber writes about it in his book about Esther, and it's a beautiful comparison where he shows literally the same words, the same turns of phrases, the same kind of idiosyncrasies of language that are part of the description of the creation and the building of the Mishkan, the very parashah we're now finished with the end of Sefer Shemot, come to life again in the Megillah, except there they describe the wealth of the king, the palace, and so forth. Almost telling us, the readers, much as the king is sending this message consciously or unconsciously to his subjects, this is not a place for God. This is not a place for spiritualism. This is not a space for introspection. This is the present, and the present is full. The present is saturated. Now, this kind of world has a cost to it. It may be intoxicating in its beauty and in its splendor, but it doesn't really leave people much room to have their own authentic expression or authentic relationships. Because in a world like that one, where the king is very much the center of gravity and he fills every space and every crack, how are people supposed to know if someone tells them something, if they mean it or not? Or if they're saying that to garner favor with a king, because that's the right thing to say. How can people ever rest secure enough in their position in the world to express them freely when today the king feels like that, tomorrow he feels like that, and you need to try and constantly predict like a crazed weatherman where the wind will blow tomorrow and try and align yourself with it? And that has a cost. As many of you know or can guess by my name, I grew up on stories of the Soviet Union and of how life under dictatorship, under a totalitarian regime, does exactly that to the people who live under it, where you never know if you can fully trust your friend. If you're living under Stalin's regime, you never know if the person who you think is your friend will be angry with you tomorrow about some minor thing, or not even angry with you, just anxious to divert attention from something he did and go and tell on you about something or other to the government. You never know, because even if you really, really think he's loyal to you, if tomorrow someone will come to arrest him and his way out of going to the gulag or to death is to make something up on you, is he not going to take that chance? Is he going to sacrifice himself to protect you? Not so clear. And while the world of the Megillah, at least at first blush, when we enter it, before we see the horror hiding underneath the glitter, seems much more benevolent, kind, and tolerant than Stalin's Soviet Union, the distorting or warping effect it has on human relationship is the same. And it starts all the way from the top. Think about Ahasuerus collecting women as if they're trophies to place on his shelf. Or and I'm not going to go into the examples particularly, but Rabbi Yoni Grossman writes about it in his book about the Megillah, where he shows that the language used to describe the collecting of the women for the king and the treatment, the cosmetic treatment they had to undergo, is very reminiscent of a Yosef story in Bereshit, in particular of the collection of grain. Women are collected as if they're foodstuff to be collected and consumed. But also of the language that's used in the Yosef story to describe the embalming of Jacob's body. In other words, it's one step further. They're not just grain, they're bodies, they're cadavers, they're objects. They're the body without a soul, because the soul, the anima, doesn't matter. It's just not of interest to the king. What's interest to him is the object, which is the body. So it starts from the top, where the king looks at everybody else at objects. But the warping effects trickle all the way down, and you see it in the way later in the Megillah, Haman's friends turn their back on him when the wind of the king's favor changes. First, when they think he's the big man in town, they're like, yeah, you should build a tree and hang Mordechai, yeah. The second the wind seems to blow against him, they're like, oh yeah, no, whatever. If Mordechai is a Jew, then whatever you started, and you start falling in front of him, then falling before him, you will fail. You will go on falling. very fickle friends, because what defines them is looking for the king's favor. You can even see a hint of it in Charvona's character, if you think about it. Charvona, Zachor Latov, a one-line character, if there ever been one, appearing at the end to tell the king, once the king is already angry at Haman, that Haman also built a tree to hang Mordechai, the king's new favorite, on, thus putting the last nail in the coffin of Haman's hopes to find a wiggle room and wriggle his way out of the predicament he found himself in. Even that, couldn't Charvona have said that earlier? But why would have he? Would, why should he have said it earlier? Now, when he sees where the wind is blowing, he can join the winning side. This is what it's like to live in the world of Shushan. This is the glittering world where there's no room for God, no room for authenticity, and no room for honest relationships that nourish us, challenge us to grow, make us feel safe because we can trust the person in front of us to tell us the truth. And into this world, into this glittering charade of a world, really, step Mordechai and Esther, and in a startling scene, offer the possibility of something different, of a different way for people to relate to one another, of a different way for people to engage, to express themselves, to think about the world. And I want to look at that scene and then examine it in the greater context of their relationship dynamic in general. And the answer, the question, sorry, we will try and unpack here together is this. What is it that this scene represents? What is the possibility, just in terms of relating to other people, that Mordechai and Esther open for us in the middle of the world of the Megillah? So without further ado, here is a source sheet. Just a moment. There you go. I'm going to go to box one if you're opening it on your own, but I'm going to start with the third source in the bottom of box one. To put it in context, this is the famous chapter four, where after Haman's genocidal plan is made public, Mordechai comes to the gate of the king's palace wearing sackcloth. Esther sends him clothes. He sends back a message saying, this is what happened, go and beg the king. And Esther tells him, but this is dangerous. It's well known. Everybody knows that you can't go to the king if you're not called upon and have not been called for many days. And then Mordechai gives this famous response. Mordechai had this message delivered to Esther. Do not imagine that you, of all the Jews, will escape with your life by being in the king's palace. On the contrary, if you keep silent in this crisis, relief and deliverance will come to the Jews from another quarter, while you and your father's house will perish. And who knows, perhaps you have attained royal position for just such a crisis. Rabbanit Yael Ziegler, here in Jerusalem, in an interpretation she wrote for Megillat Esther for a school publication in Mechlelet Emunah, pointed out that perhaps it's easy for us to assume that what Mordechai is saying is that Esther will die if she doesn't help. But in a sense, what he's saying perhaps is something deeper and more to do with her identity than with her physical survival, where he basically tells her the choice is open now before you. You can choose to be a Jew and fight as a Jew and maybe die as a Jew, but also maybe be an instrument of salvation. Or you can choose to hide your identity, to hide everything that makes you different, to be meek and silent, but then you will be lost out of history. You will fade into the background. You will have allowed the glittering world of Shushan to conquer you inward, inside, just as it controlled your outside part, your body. You will have allowed it to empty you from everything that makes you different. And you will be remembered as another comment in the long history of comments that is the history of Shushan, but you will not be part of anything greater than that. However, this is not what I want to focus on. What I want to focus on is on the fascinating transformation that Esther undergoes when she hears these words. Because instead of resisting, which was one option open to her, or the other option, which is accepting, saying, you're right, of course, I'm going to go now and beg the king, just like you told me, Esther chooses a third option. And she comes up with her own plan, a plan that is aligned with Mordechai's goal of trying to save the Jews and make her own loyalties known in the process. But in terms of means, how to get to that end offers an entirely different approach. Here is what she says in 15. Then Esther sent back this answer to Mordechai. Go, assemble all the Jews who live in Shushan and fast in my behalf. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens will observe the same fast. Then I shall go to the king, though it is contrary to the law. And if I am to perish, I shall perish. Now, why is it so remarkable that Esther is offering her own third path? It's remarkable because until this moment in the Megillah, for 3.5 chapters, we had no indication that Esther is a kind of person who might offer her own input and her own understanding of how things should happen. If you will look here at the top of box one, I have the source, the moment in chapter 2 of Megillah, where we meet Mordechai and Esther, where we see Mordechai as a man who has a lineage and a presence and an identity, as a man who does things. But Esther is constantly described as an extension, a passive vessel for other people's action. She is the girl whom Mordechai adopted. If you look at verse 7, he was foster father to Hadassah, that is Esther's uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The maiden was shapely and beautiful, and when her father and mother died, Mordechai adopted her as his own daughter. She is beautiful. She is shapely. These are just passive attributes, not something she did or created or chose. He is the one who chooses to adopt. He is the one who chooses to take her in. Just as later, the king's men choose to take her, once again in verse 8, starting in the middle of verse 8, Esther too was taken into the king's palace under the supervision of Haggai, guardian of the women. Even once she was in the palace, it wasn't as if Esther started making her own decisions. Whatever Haggai gave her and sent her, she accepted, but she didn't ask for anything. She received whatever was given to her. The only thing we are told that she actually did, ironically, is her choosing not to do something, is an avoidance of action instead of action. And even that is done on Mordechai's commands. If you look at verse 10, Esther did not reveal her people or her kindred, for Mordechai had told her not to reveal it. Every single day, Mordechai would walk about in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was faring and what was happening to her. He is walking, he is acting, he is ordering Esther, and she is complying, she is submitting, she is silently existing as an extension of other people's decisions and actions. And in case we thought that moving to the palace and being chosen as a queen will change that, it doesn't, as we see here in Esther 2:20. But Esther still did not reveal her kindred or her people as Mordechai had instructed her, for Esther obeyed Mordechai's bidding as she had done when she was under his tutelage. Yet, in that moment of crisis, when Mordechai comes and forces her to see who she is and what stands before her and understands the kind of choice she has to make, whether we understand it more simply or accept Rabbi Nitiel Ziegler's interpretation and understand it as a fundamental choice, whether she is fading into Persian history or standing up for her internal Hadassah identity and not just her external Esther identity. In that fundamental moment, Esther changes. She takes control. She uses her understanding of the court, of the king, her privileged knowledge, so to speak, to make her own plan, course her own chart. Suddenly, the passive, meek girl changes into a planner, into a general of this campaign. And perhaps even more remarkably, Mordechai accepts it and goes along with it. I'm going back to the third source here in box number one. After Esther charts her plan and says, "V'kasher avadeti avadeti," and if I am to perish, I shall perish. And then we hear the following in verse 17. So Mordechai went about the city and did just as Esther had commanded him. Earlier, she did what Ka'asher tziva aleha Mordechai. Now, Mordechai does Kechol asher tzivta alav Esther. The reason I think this is so remarkable, and if we had longer time, I would open it for discussion, but we'll just have to plow through. The reason I think this is so remarkable is that it's perfectly normal for young people to grow and become more initiative prone and take a more active role in shaping their lives. It's especially reasonable for Esther to grow into someone who takes more ownership when we think that she was for a while outside of Mordechai's sphere and acquired a different set of experiences. Every coming of age novel out there tells that story of someone starting as a child, controlled, shaped by events, and then becoming someone who shapes events instead. But not every guardian, not every authority figure, not every person who is used to being the dominant one in the relationship is capable of accepting a shift in the dynamic and placing themselves, herself, or himself in the role of the follower instead of the role of the leader after having been the leader for so long. This is, to me, really a moment of greatness of Mordechai when I read the Megillah. It's not just a moment of greatness for Esther stepping up and doing what needs to be done. It's a moment of Mordechai proving that he is capable of allowing the more capable, the more informed partner to make the call. And to just follow it as need must. And the question that I ask myself whenever I see this moment is why? What is it about Mordechai that allows him to make this change, that allows him to accept this shift in dynamic? Now, if we were to open this for discussion here, I'm sure there would have been many, many answers. In a previous, I talked to a bunch of seminary girls, 18-year-olds, about it. One of them pointed out that you need to have a good sense of self-worth to be able to shift like that. That if you feel that your self-worth is dependent on the awe with which people treat you, it'll be very hard for you to let go of that awe and take the follower position. So that's definitely, I think, a part of it. There's another direction one can answer, which is that Mordechai is wise and he understands that Esther has some privileged knowledge here that he would do well to follow. But I think that no matter what your particular answer, or what psychological aspect of Mordechai you want to focus on, there's an underlying cause. And that is what I want to focus on with the time we have left. The underlying cause is that while this conversation is between two people, and while in this conversation they're expressing their authentic fears, concerns, aspirations, what unites them in this moment is not just the relationship with one another, but a cause they share that goes beyond the boundaries of their relationship. In this moment, Mordechai and Esther are not just an uncle and niece, a more veteran courtier and a young woman. They're not just a Jew and a queen. They are two people who share a goal, which is to protect and save the entire human nation. This is their goal that they share. The second this is the motivating force, the fact that they disagree about means and methods, the fact that they have some misalignment in the beginning about who should take what role, who should take what step, should Esther do something, is it too dangerous, is it a risk worth taking? All of those things are just details. Because at the heart of their interaction stands a shared goal. And once Esther sees the way to achieve that shared goal, that allows Mordechai to step back and take second fiddle, so to speak, because it's not about him and it's not about her. It's about what they're trying to achieve. In that regard, I think that Mordechai and Esther are a perfect example of a concept the Rambam develops in his interpretation for Pirkei Avot. A Rambam says that there are three types of friendships in the world. There's a friendship for benefit, where you want to get something out of another person. Let's see it in the source sheet. I'm open it. I'm going to go ahead, skip ahead to the last box, box number four. A friend for benefit, he writes, is like the friendship of two business partners and the friendship of king and his retinue. In other words, the glittering world of Shushan that we described in the beginning, that is the kind of friendships it allows for. A friendship where you're trying to get something. Now, it's not always deceptive. It's not necessarily manipulative. Two business partners signing a contract are under no delusions that they will always like each other and always be best friends. Their interests are aligned for the duration of whatever it is they're trying to get from one another as specified in their contract, and that's perfectly fine. It's just a little depressing when that's all there is, when all you see when you look at other people are objects to be used, are interests to be gained. The next level up, as Rambam says, is a friendship for enjoyment. And he says there are two types, a friend for pleasure and a friend for confidence. Indeed, the friend for pleasure, like the friendship of males and females and similar to it, whereas the friend for confidence is when a man has a friend to whom he can confide his soul. He will not keep anything from him, not in action and not in speech, and he will make him know all of his affairs, the good ones and the disgraceful, without fearing from him that any loss will come to him with all of this. This is already the kind of friendship that's not possible if you buy into a Ahasuerus world where the center of gravity is the king's favor, and that's the ultimate goal, that and survival, I should say. That is all, that kind of confidence, that kind of trust is not possible in that world. However, to Rambam, that's not the epitome, not the pinnacle of friendship, but rather there's another step, another rung in the ladder. And that is here, a friend for virtue is when the desire of both of them and their intention is for one thing, and that is the good. And each one wants to be helped by his friend in reaching this good for both of them together. And this is the friend which he commanded to acquire. And it is like the love of the master for the student and of the student for the master. Student master here specifically, Rambam means Talmid Chacham, right? The rabbi and his student, who are both motivated by love of Torah. And this love of Torah means that they're sharing one pursuit. Now, I hope that we are all fortunate to have some people in our lives that share our pursuits and our beliefs to that extent. Rav Soloveitchik says that at times marriage, for example, or other familial relationships are of that sort. But I don't want to discuss really types of friendships. That's not really the point. The point I'm trying to draw by bringing this source, bringing this observation that Rambam makes, in which he distinguishes between friendship that is for confidence, friendship that's based on trust and respect and love, wonderful though they are, and friendship that's based on a cause that goes beyond the self, beyond even the two people engaged in the relationship, is that it helps us understand what allowed Mordechai to change his place within the relationship. Because the shared cause becomes the important, that's the center of gravity for him. And if that's the center of gravity, he can step back, he can step forth, he can prod Esther when necessary, and then accept her authority and her instructions when necessary. Because the judgment, the thing that makes him judge every instant and how to act about it, isn't something between them, but it's something outside of them. And in that regard, the relationship between Mordechai and Esther invites into the Megillah a different center of gravity, an alternative center of gravity, one that instead of distorting and warping everybody's relationship with one another, like the king's favor does in the beginning, in the glittering mishteh and the collection of the women, invites people to ask what is their motivating cause, and when they find it, use that as a measure of their actions. And that is something that already invites each person both to introspection, to understanding who they are, to aligning with their own deepest values, and to making room for one another and working together in a way that instead of objectifying other people and keeping them frozen in their place as something to be used as a resource, as grains, as cadavers, you name it, gives them room to surprise you and make you change and make you grow. Now, there's one final comment I want to make, but I want to look at the questions that came up in the chat and see if there's something I can address first. If you have any questions, please add them here. Naomi Bar-Yam wrote about the conversation between Esther and Mordechai. Do they disagree or are they complementing one another? Naomi, could you elaborate what you mean here?
Well, it doesn't seem to me that they're actually disagreeing, but that, as you pointed out, each of them has a different vision, visibility and sphere that they know about, and that they complement one another, complement with an E, not compliment, say nice things about, complement, complete one another in terms of their knowledge and therefore the action going forward.
That's a fair point. And my answer is that it's somewhere in between, because yes, I agree, they're complementing one another, but it's clear that at first they don't see it this way. The beginning of the interaction has Mordechai pushing, Esther rebuffing, pushing back, him pushing again, and then her offering a deuter and alternative. So mm-hmm. yes, at the end of the day, we see that they complement one another. But the getting to there seems as if they're at loggerheads or a disagreement of some sort. Rabbi Grossman points out that the beginning of that chapter doesn't describe Esther as Esther, but rather as Amalka, Vatitchalchel Amalka Me'od, almost emphasizing that she's coming from the perspective of the queen of the Persian Empire, the Persian court. She's identified with her role in it, compared to Michal Bat Shaul looking at King David dancing in the street, compared to Michal Eshet David helping him escape her father, meaning the way someone is characterized in the story tells us what they identify. So she needs to be shaken out of this identification in the conversation, and yet she reveals in the course of it that deep down she is not that, she's more than that. I want to add one final comment before we finish and leave you with one thought, which is that to me, this conversation, this theme, this idea of relationships that allow people room to grow and change through them instead of forcing them into a box goes all the way back to Etz Hadat, to the tree of knowledge. Because in Genesis 2, in the story of creation, second story of creation, but the story where we meet Adam as more than just a species, but rather as a person, as someone with a personality, with an identity, the tree of knowledge is created and the injunction not to eat it is created before Eve. Almost as if to train man, and here it is man, it's not humanity in general, to know that there are certain things that are beautiful and tempting, but you can't consume. They're not yours to consume. Only when humanity learns to draw these lines and make these spaces for themselves and make room for something in the world to exist that you can't just use as your desire sees fit, then you can bring another person into creation and allow a real relationship to grow. So there it's about limitation. In Esther, it's about shared cause. My wish for all of us is that in all our meaningful relationships, we will find that thing that allows the relationship to be meaningful and allow us to grow and become more than we were at its beginning. Thank you so much, and I wish you all Purim Sameach, even despite and within this moment that we're experiencing right now. Thank you.
That was fantastic.
Thank you very much, Raquel. Thank you. Okay, we'll take a one-minute break, and Dina Blaustein is ready to go, and we just made her co-host. She'll be making her debut for Torah in Motion, if I can say that. So thank you very much. Raquel, thank you very much. Purim Sameach. All the best. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to go get Rabbi Silver's book and Yoni Grossman's book, two great books that I have sitting on my bookcase. So I recommend highly to read, although I don't think either of them is in English. I think they're both only in Hebrew. Is Yoni Grossman's book being translated into English? Megillat Starim? It's a great book.
I don't know that it's been translated. I don't know. I
All
honestly
right.
don't.
Yeah. Whatever. You should read it in Hebrew anyway. Okay. All right. We'll start in 45 seconds. Thank you.